Hey everybody, this is the Brothers Wisp number 52. You've got myself, Greg Soule, down here in the motherland, Texas. With me today is Mike Hammett up in the Chicago way. Chicago way is not a euphemism for murdering people, is it?
No, it's just for our method of taxations and who gets jobs and who gets put in the office.
Who greases what wheels? I get you. All right. Fair enough. This one looks like it's going to be short and sweet. We didn't actually have kind of technically a Brothers Wisp podcast 2 weeks ago because we did kind of the shorty. Well, it wasn't really shorty. You guys talked for a while on the switch chips that Microtik's starting to use. So we use any excuse to get out of extra work if we can. So there you go. This week, let's see, starting it off, Ubiquiti Front Row. If you guys haven't seen it, you should give it a look. Give it a click. I'll let Mike give the intro on this. What do you think about the front row, Mike?
I don't really know why. And that seems to be kind of a universal response. Like, I mean, some people are going overboard in their criticisms. It's just like, nobody understands why.
All right, so let's say what it is first. It's it's like an Android device, like a medallion's kind of circular, maybe a couple inches, maybe 3 inches in diameter.
My description of it is, it's a Flavor Flav camera.
Flavor Flav camera. Yeah, it looks like a clock hanging around your neck. They have it in black and kind of a silver with a pink bezel. That silver pink one reminds me of the new iPhone color scheme. They have that that rose color or whatever.
I don't pay attention to iPhones, so I don't know.
Well, I mean, it feels very Ubiquiti design, the way it looks. It's very sleek. It's got a camera front and back. It does, I think, 1080p or maybe 720p. I think it's 1080p video recording. It's got a little screen on there, touchscreen, runs Android. I think the idea is you can live stream your life. I guess it pairs to your phone through Bluetooth and allows you to sort of do social media sharing and stuff like that, and maybe do time-lapse things. I think that's part of it, too.
Yeah, it'll do something like an hour 45 to 2 hours of video. It's a little bit shorter if you're live streaming than if you're just recording on the built-in storage. Oh, it's reading an alert about a UPS failure at a data center. I should be okay, though.
But this is like a social media play, right? I mean, that's what this thing is for sharing your life.
It's got built-in support for Facebook Live, Twitter Live, YouTube Live. Then it'll also do, I think it said it'll do 16 hours of time-lapse photos, off the built-in battery. So that's interesting.
I know it's not wholly a new idea. I've seen devices like this for years where I saw one that was roughly the size of a quarter that you would pin to your shirt and it would take time-lapse photos all day, every day while you had it on. I guess the idea was you could kind of make this timeline of your life and go back. And then now I know they have similar ones like this that record video. To my knowledge, I guess this is the first that's sort of doing the live stream thing. In my mind, I'm thinking this is Ubiquiti to its shareholders. I think, didn't they say that every quarter they're going to be announcing something new, some new products, some new feature, right? And this kind of goes along with it. I think a lot of people are saying that this is so outside of what you would normally see from Ubiquiti. Does it even belong in the Ubiquiti product line kind of thing?
Which I think that kind of holds true with like all the press we've seen on it and like the website. Like, it barely, if at all, mentions Ubiquiti. It's just Front Row is the brand.
I think they've had a lot of creep in the last couple of years. That What's the home Wi-Fi access points that have the boosters?
Amplify.
Yeah, it looks like a cube, right? So that's very much a home market they were chasing after. And this sort of feels like an extension, I guess, of that, right? Kind of moving in that direction a little bit as opposed to the obviously not enterprise market.
Yeah. No, it's it is completely separate, you know, branding like the Amplify, except I believe, you know, in some more of the tech articles, you'll see a bit more on the Amplify, you know, saying it's ubiquity. I think at least somewhat relating to, you know, likening it to the Unify line. But, you know, Amplify, you know, seemed a lot more like that made a sense a lot more. You know, they're solving, you know, it's still connected to their ecosystem. Of, you know, if someone brings internet down to a home, you know, now they could use Amplify throughout the home to, you know, ensure, you know, adequate Wi-Fi coverage throughout for, you know, for their service. And, you know, some of the reviews I've read have, you know, rated Amplify, you know, very favorably compared to Google Wi-Fi, and there's some others I don't really care about.
Yeah, I've seen some really good reviews on the Amplify stuff lately. And it's supposedly really easy to use, right? Which is that home user market. That's what they're shooting for. I don't know. I don't... Maybe the front row will spin out and just kind of do its own little thing. To me, this sort of makes me think of like the... what was it? The Flip that Cisco made? It was a little... about the size of a smartphone, but recorded video and did that, you know, and it had like a little USB port that would flip out on it.
I just know that they were really successful at that because I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. They were insanely successful. I actually talked to a Cisco guy one time, like a regional sales guy. And I was like, so what's the story on this? Why did you guys even do this? And he goes, well, I mean, it was a good idea 5 years ago. But now everybody's got that little thing in their pocket that takes its place, you know, a phone, obviously. So in my mind, this thing's competing with, your space, right? Like for a phone, I guess the idea is this is going to do the live streaming thing that your phone wouldn't do, only it's hands-free because it's around your neck. I don't know if that's enough motivation for somebody to buy it, but who knows, man? I don't know.
You know, and what I don't get is a front camera and a reverse camera. Like, if you're wearing it around your neck, what's the other camera going to take a picture of?
Maybe you just hold, I don't know, maybe you hold it up so you can see front and back at the exact same time when you're streaming stuff.
I think they're going to have some different mounts for it, like a mount to go on a bike and some other things. And I guess there's room for customization with the whole, you know, face being, you know, a screen, or largely being a screen. You know, you could even get some sort of a, you know, clock app on there to, you know, pay homage to its roots.
For sure. While we're talking about ubiquity, because I'm done with the front row, while we're talking about ubiquity, somebody asked about the UCRM. Honestly, I've just done a little cursory research, played with the demo, so I don't really have any hands-on, and honestly, I'm not sure who does have hands-on at this point. But the UCRM is your one-stop shop, I guess, for a new WISP, or I'm assuming they want every WISP to use it that uses Ubiquity products, but it is your system, right? It administers your customers, you add your customers, it does your scheduling for truck installs, it does your ticket system, you know, for customer interactions, and it also does your billing, right? As well as traffic control as in you add a customer in, it'll put a rate limit in there for them. And then if, you know, like the automated billing portion doesn't complete, it'll suspend the customer. And, you know, it's kind of your, I guess, your back end CRM system. I know it also gives you the ability to sort of sort customers by those that have been suspended. You can sort by those that are experiencing an outage, right? Their customer device is down, or I'm guessing the tower they generally hang off of is down, so that's going to be same difference. I know you can sort of see all of the APs, so you can see all of your sectors and things like that on the field. I'm not sure, is the UCRM, are they supposed to add, and they may already, because I know I've looked at something, but are they adding edge routers into this and air fibers? I mean, are you going to be able to see those, Mike, to your knowledge?
I have no idea what their intentions are, because several years ago, they had, you know, coming soon, UCRM billing and UCRM control. And the UCRM control was the replacement for air control because, speculating, you know, the air control team, you know, disappeared for whatever reasons. There was just no development for years. So they call it new, you know, UCRM control, except it's going to be cloud hosted only. So then Wisp complained loudly. Then they said, okay, we'll make a local install version. So they did that, and, you know, it was pretty, like, Ubiquiti, lacking features. And then it kind of seemed to slow down a little bit. And then, you know, shortly after the MFR virus, all of a sudden, you know, here's some patches for air control so that you can clean up, you know, your infections. And then here's some more things for air control. And then, oh, here's a new web interface for air control, which didn't have a web interface at all before. And here's some more things for air control. So then UCRM control seems to have died, giving its user interface back to the original air control.
And so air control originally, while we're talking about it, that was really just device administration, right?
Well, it's hard to say because they never actually finished any of them so far.
but I mean, that's what people were using them for, right? To
It's supposed to be for monitoring
stuff.
It's supposed to be for monitoring control configuration, except they don't have anything for configuration yet. Like, it's supposed to, which isn't there yet. 4 years after they started the project. I don't know anything about, I keep seeing people asking about, you know, people's thoughts on the UCRM, which may be all that's left of UCRM is the billing component. Like, they might even mention the control aspect anymore. You've got some people asking about it, but most WISPs I see talking, they've got something else. And that they're more than happy with it, be it Wismon, PowerCode, Sonar. There's this new Splinks thing people seem to be getting excited about. There's just on and on and on. There's dozens of them. And nobody seems to really care about UCRM.
Well, I think that's kind of the double-edged sword of stuff like this, right? If you've got a commercial product, you're paying for that product, right? Your dollars are... portion of your dollars are going to go in to pay programmers and towards the development, whereas this is a free product, so it's sort of like the internet best effort, right? They're going to put some time into it, but never continual maintenance.
Yeah,
or so it seems.
And my intent wasn't just purely to rant about their whole "are we going to do air control or not," but that level of ADD is probably why people aren't willing to pick up Ubiquiti for their billing system, because who knows when they're going to stop doing it.
Yeah. Well, stuff like this, I always see this as, hey, new guy that's looking to do a WISP, this is perfect for you, right? We're going to give you the one-stop shop. You're going to use our gear anyway. It's the cheapest gear on the market. So I think that's probably what it's targeted towards. And a lot of this stuff, people will get started with it, and if they hit some limitations, they'll migrate off. But looking at the demo stuff, it looks pretty cool. Like, there's a feature in there that I thought was really cute where whenever you have a customer in the system, it'll automatically do statistics on that customer. So it'll ping that guy, right, and create graphs all the time and show his utilization and stuff like that. And you can go back and look at that trended information, right? It's not something you have to manually add to a system somewhere. So I thought that was really cute. So monitoring systems, whenever somebody's starting up a WISP, pretty much I've never seen anybody start with good monitoring. This kind of helps them out with that a little bit, you know, kind of takes some of that out, which I think is really cool.
I think that Ubiquity is going to have to show consistent development and improvement in the at least on the billing aspect for, like, I know they've been doing it for a while now. Well, I guess I don't know if it's consistent because I don't pay attention to it. But I would say they probably have to be doing it for at least another year just to prove that they're not going to just vanish. Because, MFi Cloud or one of the other clouds, it was like, yes, we're going to have this great service. Oh, by the way, in 30 days, we're shutting it down.
Yeah.
Who can do their billing on that? And I guess to add another level of ADD to this, so I was just going on about, how they went from air control to UCRM control back to air control with the UCRM control interface. Except air control already isn't their most recent product because they have UNMS.
Yeah. Management monitoring system.
That's already slated to replace air control. Like, they already have a roadmap and everything of what products they're adding and when.
You know, it's interesting. If you look at the UCRM roadmap, towards the bottom, 1, 2, 3, 4, four feature blocks down, they say UNMS, extended network management monitoring through the UNMS integration. So they're on their roadmap. UCRM has plans to integrate with UNMS, and they're indicating that they're working on that now.
Okay, that's promising. I don't remember where I saw the UNMS roadmap, but I did see an official one somewhere, and monitoring. Configuration, control, so on, different levels across all Ubiquity product lines, when they're implementing what. And some of these things, I think air fiber configuration isn't even due to be available for another year and a half. But they've got it all laid out. And if they have a roadmap for the UNMS or the UCRM, then...
Is UNMS the interface that... the new Ubiquity Infinity Edge Router, is that what it's called? The one with all the 10 gig interfaces? On their demo page, they had a configuration demo thing, and it went to some page full of gear. Was that UNMS that it was demoing?
I'm guessing so, because I think... Oh, here we go. Right on the UNMS website is where they have the roadmap.
There you go.
Because I believe UNMS... all of the first products are all edge routers, edge switches, edge points, U-fibers. It's all that new stuff.
Yeah, and everything's... It has to be, alpha and beta versions of software to be able to administer it through there. So I can't imagine too many people are actually running it in production yet.
Yeah, or if they have it running, maybe not depending upon it. It's running and, they check it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to be running alpha code on a lot of gear for it to actually pop up in there.
Oh,
so.
True.
Yeah, so you're probably not running that. Speaking of the Infinity, just kind of digging around a little bit, I think I saw some people saying that at least early on when they were running the beta versions that they were having some show-stopping bugs with them in the BGP implementation. I think they said it was maxing out one of the cores. So I guess it's single-threaded and just having some problems there.
Was it on Nanog you saw that?
Oh, man, there's no telling.
I saw something similar where they got brought up by Nanog and said that they had, you tried the latest version or whatever, and it wasn't any better. And I checked, and that latest version was replaced, 5 months prior, 4 months prior. So really, they hadn't run the latest version yet. So maybe they already fixed that.
There you go.
To go off on a tangent of a tangent, You mentioned BGP and single core and whatnot, and I still see people talking about, you know, when, you know, router OS becomes, you know, multi-core BGP, multi-thread BGP, and it's not. They're just making the single threaded better. That's all that it is. Yet people still, was it like 3 years after Giannis told us about it, at one of the MUMs, people are still thinking it's going to be multi-threaded. It's not.
Yeah.
Almost no routing platform is multi-threaded to that point. Like only one or two of them are, including Cisco and Junipers and all that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that end, to be honest with you, I don't care how you make the sausage, as long as at the end of the day, it's delicious. Yeah. Right.
Just make it faster. I don't care how.
Yeah. Who cares? It doesn't really matter to me. I'm not, Andrew Thiff would probably argue with you. He wants to know, every step of the process. But for me, I just, sometimes I really just want it to work. It's not the intricacies of the transistors used inside the ICs isn't as important to me as it just functioning.
And he seems to know all that.
I know. That's what breaks my brain. He can somehow retain all of that. I'm incapable. Maybe that's why I don't care, because I know I can't do it.
Well, as long as you know that.
Well, speaking of BGP, let's keep tangenting. Somebody said they were interested in BGP, and I asked them what specifically, and they said, I don't know, just stuff in general. I don't know where to go. So I was thinking about it. What do I? What's different about BGP that we haven't talked about? And I was thinking how I connect to some customers in a redundant environment. If they've got a chunk of addressing, right, and they're, say, connected to, I mean, it can work in a WISP, it can work in a data center, they're two towers, or in a data center, they're going to be coming from two kind of different locations, and they're coming back into your gear. If I'm routing a chunk of addressing to them, you want to do that dynamically, right? So if any one link in the chain fails, there's some kind of dynamic negotiation. BGP being Border Gateway Protocol, it will communicate between two peers, and they'll share NLRI in the form of routes, right? That's really what we're talking about, routing information here. You could theoretically run OSPF. I wouldn't trust my OSPF implementation with a customer, right? Because OSPF's made to be very fast, and so it runs a little heavier, right? And so if there's a link flapping, things like that, OSPF's going to get a little crazy. When it's doing convergence, the CPU is going to spike. BGP is a lot friendlier. Especially if you're doing a lot of filtering in your BGP and you're just seeing a couple of routes come up and down, even if somebody's flapping, say with BGP dampening, you can kind of quiet that, right? It's made to be graceful for the most part. But seeing as though I don't trust people with my OSPF implementations, I'll use BGP in those scenarios to peer with those guys to let them get some redundancy in that fashion. That's generally how I do it. And if they're not some big fancy company with their own autonomous system number from Aaron and their own addressing, I'll let them use my addressing, and I'll just give them a private BGP AS.
Sure. I hadn't got around to it yet, but I was going to ask you guys about that in our Slack. I haven't done, anything with, private ASN with anybody, I've got a customer that I've just turned up as another ISP. He's not big enough he does have multiple upstreams now that are BGP capable, but he doesn't have his own ASN yet, because he doesn't have a slash 24. It's not that high on his priority list right now, because it's now like $4,000 to $4,500 just to buy a slash 24 from somebody else, so you have one. But anyway, tangents. So I was thinking about, is there anything special in turning up that, or is it just like any other BGP peer, just use a number out of the private ASN range that, they're not already using. And obviously, filter adjustments, because they're probably not doing slash 24s. Is there anything else special?
In my experience, you pretty much nailed it. If, say, I'm the upstream and I'm doing And it's my addressing that I'm just giving somebody a, I don't know, I'm giving them a /29 or, you know, I'm giving them 8 IPs or something like that. That's inside their router that, you know, is floating back and forth, right? That route is what they're using. I'm paired with them with a private ASN. When that comes to me, it's still going to be technically from that private ASN. Inside my route tables, it'll say, hey, to reach this addressing, you got to go through this other autonomous system. Now, when it wants to go through my upstreams, you know, I'm kicking it out to the internet, either through an exchange or through an internet provider, you know, Cogent, Comcast, Zayo, whoever, level three, whatever your upstream happens to be. They aren't going to know that private ASN, just like RFC 1918 private addressing, right? So there's, and every manufacturer's got, it's different for everybody, but it's basically remove private ASN. So what it'll do is if it sees a private ASN when it's going to a specific designated peer, so to your upstreams, you'll say remove any private ASNs to them. It'll strip that private ASN and it'll replace it with yours and send it out. So it's a way of allowing somebody to peer within you. You know, it'll stay maintained inside your infrastructure, but when it wants to go to upstreams, it wipes out that private ASN so that it actually is internet routable in a normal fashion. That's kind of the only sort of thing you have to remember.
Yeah, and so for those trying to figure out where this is, routing BGP peers, you know, open up one of your peers on your general tab, towards the bottom is a remove private ASN checkbox. I assume you just enable that on your upstream and away you go.
Yeah, Bob's your uncle. Easy peasy. I mean, you can do that with peers. Say you've got a whole bunch of private ASN peers and you want them, you know, to not know about other people's privates. You could do it to them as well. So it would just mask those privates.
Yeah.
That's right. Keep it in your pants. Yeah. So you have the option to do it there as well. So it's entirely up to you.
Okay. So now what are your thoughts on, okay, so in this specific example of mine, they've got a /27 from me. I think maybe a /27 from somebody else. And some other allocations. What are your thoughts on, since I know the guy, I trust him to some degree, not much, but, you know, nothing personal, just he's a network that's separate from mine, not under my control. Thoughts on, okay, so obviously he's going to advertise, you know, the /27 that I gave him to me. Would it be acceptable for me to accept his other /27 being advertised to me? Obviously, I can't pass it upstream, but at least my network to his network, you know, if for some reason someone of my network wants to talk to his, I can't imagine it's going to be anything more than port scans. But you know, would that be an acceptable thing for me to allow him to advertise his other /27 to me?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're 100% correct. Anything less than a /24, you're not going to be able to send to your upstreams. I mean, even then you'd have to, depending on who your upstreams are, if you did want to send somebody else's /24 out, you know, you have to, in Aaron, you have these, or really any of the, what, RIDBs, they're called assets, ASSET, autonomous system sets. So you have to have somebody else's routes in your asset that basically says, hey, these networks are transiting me. Otherwise, they can get filtered out there. And then also your upstreams, usually you have to send them an email anyway and say, hey, add these to my filter list. And they're going to be sourced from these guys, right? I think you should, and I'm okay with that because I want them to be tightly controlled. Don't trust me. That's fine because I don't trust anybody else. Whenever I peer with people, I put filter lists in place that says only this address space is allowed to come from them. And then two, it has to be sourced from these autonomous system numbers, right? I don't want them accidentally leaking their full internet route table to me, you know, if it's some customer, because I would sure hate for them to become a transit point because I don't want to tip them over.
Sure.
You know, things like that. But let's see, where was I going with this? We started out someplace and I got lost halfway through. What was the, oh yeah, yeah, somebody advertising. Yeah, I think it's absolutely great, right? Because that's offload. So neither of you have to burn any of your internet transit links, right? And also the fact that your two routers are connected, you're going to get a lot better latency there.
Sure.
We peer with, say, the local university. So we do a lot of apartment complexes in town. And so all of those students are accessing the university's network. The last thing they want to do is have all, you know, 6,000 of those kids burning their internet links up if they can help it. So instead, we just direct peer with those guys, right? So obviously, I can't advertise their address space out my internet connections, but I can still do offload. So as those apartment users come into my network, they'll just cut straight over to that direct peering with the university. Saves me bandwidth. So I'm all about it. And they get an elevated experience, which makes them, you know, it gives the perception that our network's better because in effect, or rather in effect, it is because better latency. You know, it's not best effort out hitting on the internet. It's just a direct my cable to their router. So I think anytime you can elevate an experience, that's a win. And anytime you can save yourself transit, that's another big win.
Yeah. It's, you know, obviously I do some work with that on a larger scale, the internet exchanges, which is, you know, there everybody's using, you know, regular internet slash 24s and aboves with public ASNs and, you know, so on.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, you trust this guy, you know what blocks of addressing he's got. And as long as you set your filters to that block or smaller, you're going to be safe. He's not going to accidentally advertise 8.8.8 to you, you know, which would be horrible. You know, you don't want all of a sudden Google being sourced on his network, you know, something crazy like that. So
sure.
As long as you're protecting yourself on what routes he can send you, you should be fine.
It's a tangent. I was just looking at see the most recent comments on a post I made on Facebook. Really happened, I think, before we even started the cast. Someone's complaining about my lack of use of a headset. So maybe I'll finally have to buy a headset. People keep complaining about that.
They hate hearing you type. It sounds like you're eating Fritos on the podcast.
Maybe I am. And also complaining about me dropping out. Do I drop out a lot?
No, not usually.
All right.
It's usually the international guys that pop out.
I guess on another tangent on that then, I was playing around in Megaport's portal a few weeks ago. You know, Megaport is kind of like an SDN exchange. You know, you choose who you want to talk to at what, you know, at whichever of their pops, and, you know, tell it what VLAN you want, how fast you want it, click OK. You know, it bills your credit card and it's active within minutes. But I was looking to see, you know, what it would cost to just appear from my data center here back to Auckland so I could, you know, have a direct peer with 50. And it was, I forget what it was. It was like $900-some a month for like a 50 meg connection.
That's insane.
And I'm like, you know what, Thrift? I don't think you're really worth that. but when, like, you know, it's just purely because it's, you know, international, transoceanic stuff, you know, 50 megs over to, you know, LA was like $16 or something like that.
Yeah, it's not terrible. Yeah, it's, I think if you're, with their nodes, if you're whatever is, you know, they have it broken into regions. So if you're in region, transport from one region node to the next is actually free. So, you know, if I was going from Houston to Dallas, I would pay for a gig. I think it's somewhere around $200 on each side for a gig port, and the transit in between would be free. So $400 for a gig is a hell of a good price. I think 10 gig bumps it up to $500 a port, I think. So it'd be $1,000 if you're within region, $1,000 for a 10 gig transport. It's actually pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I know to go to any of their providers. So if you want to go to any of the big three hosting providers, so I connect to Megaport, they give me one physical cable. If I want to go to Google, Azure, or AWS, it's $200 to go to each one. So each extra one you add is another $200. And you can divvy it up however you want. So if you've got a 10 gig link, you can say, give me 1 gig to Azure and, give me 9 gigs over to AWS. And it will auto-provision within a couple of minutes. You basically tell it what 802.1q VLAN tag to send each one on. So all of that comes on the same wire. It just comes to you tagged. Super crazy how that works. And they've made it so easy that you can even use your Facebook login on their portal, which is insane.
It doesn't have to be as, rounded off as 1 gig or 9 gig. You could have 937 megabits if you so want. Oh, yeah.
And if you have that now, that's fine. And 20 minutes from now you want to change it, you can. And it auto provisions in the portal. There's no charge associated with that. It just, you get charged once a month, and they're month to month contracts. You're not even locked in anything. It's crazy. Any data center you're going to go into, I can't say any, probably about, 70% of data centers on cross connects, they want a term in there, right? So it's usually going to at least be a year. Some data centers will actually let you go month to month along with it. So if you're in a month to month data center and the Megaport is month to month, it gives you a lot of flexibility there. I mean, it's good for, think too, if you're doing redundancy in data centers, you have a Megaport node here and a Megaport node in the other one, you're going to get inexpensive transport. You're going to get direct connect to the big players. I mean, there's some other people that hang off to them. Or say you're doing a data center migration. You're going from one facility to the other. That's a month-to-month contract. So you migrate, keep it there as long as you need to, then shut it off. So sure. It makes it almost too convenient.
Sure. So we roll back our tangents. Let's roll back our tangents. Where would we end up?
We just finished off Ubiquiti UCRM.
Oh yeah, we're on the BGP stuff. Yeah.
So something else you had on the list, actually something wireless newsworthy, is you had Bridgewave has announced a 10 gig, 80 gigahertz link that does AES 256 encryption on it. So 80 gigahertz, they're saying long haul. And the dish looked like it was about a 2 foot dish. How far are we talking about? Because 80 gigahertz, that's going to be very susceptible to rain fade and things like
sure.
that.
Sure.
Right?
If you build it in areas without rain, so like say the Atacama Desert, you could do it probably 7-8 miles reliably.
Wow. Although the heat characteristics could change things, right?
In my area, 1 to 2 miles.
1 to 2 miles. So when they say long haul is 1 to 2 miles at 80 gigahertz. But that's 10 gigs you're pushing. So that's a lot. That's a lot of bandwidth.
In my area, the longest link in my area at 80 gig is, I think it's about 14 or 15 miles.
Wow.
But it's one of those high frequency trader guys. And so they've got six different paths and, they choose.
So you're not saying
different paths, lengths, different part.
So you're saying it's not one continuous link, it's multiple spans.
Oh, yeah. No, like they have one radio and then they go 15 miles. And there's the other radio.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it is. Are these like 10 foot dishes or something?
Probably just 2 foot. So I don't think I've really seen I've only seen a 3 foot dish once in that band. Those guys, they don't really care if it goes down because they have 5 or 6 paths and they send the same data out every path.
Hmm.
And so it's just, first destination wins. And so if they can build these longer paths or longer links, then there's less latency of going through electronics.
I gotcha. So if it's up, that's great. I win because I'm getting it there just a few microseconds faster.
Yeah.
If it's down, so be it. I'll just lose a few $1,000 a day or something.
Yeah. That, you know, it is, you know, but, yeah, you know, I don't understand those guys, but whatever. They keep spending more and more money. They're building more and more towers in my area. It's just getting worse. But so I think that makes two or three guys now that make 10 gigabit, 80 gigahertz links. You've got BridgeWave. I think ViewBic makes one. I forget if theirs is 80 gigahertz or 60 gigahertz. I think 80. There might be another one.
I think CI makes them, don't they?
I know they have them up there. I don't know if they're 10 gigs or not.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I know they have 80 gig stuff. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I'm not sure they're 10 gig.
It could be 2 or 5 or something like that, you know, gigabit. It could be 10. Okay. I think one of the traditional guys, like NEC or Ericsson or something like that, has some. I don't remember who they are, but there's a couple of them. I know what the price is. If it's BridgeWave, it's going to be ridiculous. They've been around for a long time, and it's really talked about because they're really expensive.
Gotcha. So while we're talking about manufacturers, DragonWave, everybody's heard of DragonWave. I guess they're one of the institutions in the industry for years. A little bit of unfortunate news for them.
Yeah, they apparently couldn't handle. I hear that the main reason for the fault was the Nokia buyout of Alcatel-Lucent, in that one of them, I forget which one it was, Nokia or Alcatel-Lucent, one of them, bought all of their links. I think Nokia bought all of their microwave links from DragonWave, and for all their integrations and things. They may have had some white labeling, I'm not sure. But when they bought Alcatel-Lucent, who made microwave links, they obviously kind of stopped purchasing them from DragonWave. And it's like it sounds like when the bankruptcy was declared, like they already had a new buyer in mind because of some sort of expedited chapter or something or other thing. So it sounds like they already knew their exit strategy. It's just going through the motions. So it sounds like they're not going to go away entirely. It just could be a rough little bit.
A restructuring, is that what they call that?
Well, I don't think it's in this case, I don't think it's a restructuring because they're being acquired by somebody.
Oh, they're just straight up getting bought.
Yeah, but I think the buyout is conditional upon the bankruptcy, and so they have to go do that first.
All right, they're going to shed some debt, huh?
But they always make good products. They're just always really expensive. But I hear that the latest ones, Harmony, I think they call them, or HEMC, something like that, Harmony Enhanced Multicore. They went with the multicore route that Ceragon and CI and some others have done, where they have multiple polarities and channels all in. And so therefore you can do multiple gigabits with one physical radio unit, and that they were in the same price range as the other guys. They weren't overblown price.
I gotcha, for sure. While we're talking about hardware, you have a note in here about 100 gig switches. What's on your mind?
Well, I didn't get a chance to fully look into all of that because I got distracted by our podcast. but started to look into acquiring one. We've officially had somebody ask our exchange for a 100 gig port.
Wow.
I don't know as if they're going to use it all that much because of until aggregate traffic of everything else already on the exchange isn't 100 gigabit. But you know, if they want to pay for it, I'll sell to them.
if you can make it work out time wise. So what are you looking for? Oh, is this the, because I saw you post up a question, something about what do you guys think about Cumulus, you know, kind of the SDN OSs that you can put on Whitebox. I'm guessing this is why you asked that question, like which OS have you had experience with, good or bad? And this is for any of the listeners too, because Mike posted it up there, and I don't think there was a whole lot of feedback. I'm not sure a lot of people have used Whitebox switches, honestly, but if you have, let us know.
Well, I think I posted it today, maybe this afternoon, so not a lot of time for a lot of activity.
Yeah.
But you are right in that there's not a lot of people, you know, using that kind of stuff. There's a few people on there that have used various brands of software, and it's, you know, it's almost universal in that, you know, any white box switch will take any white box OS, but it's not quite, it's like, you know, 95% overlap. Mm. You know, because some people have special drivers that, you know, maybe not everybody has, but, you know,
whose white boxes have you been looking at?
I think EdgeCore is probably near the top of the list that I'm looking at. Basically what I was going to kind of do is when I went through, figured out kind of, you know, what software I wanted, then look through their supported hardware list and see what was on there. But I know that I've seen somebody's switch for, 100 gig switch. I think it was like a 32 port 100 gig. It was like $7,000 maybe.
Oh, wow. That's not bad. That's not bad at all. I know Fiberstore has some 100 gig stuff, and I actually, their documentation is fairly limited on what they have on there. I mean, they have several switches, but yeah, the documentation is fairly limited. I think I forwarded it to the group on one of them, and it seemed like most of your average feature sets that you're looking for are in there. I have no idea what the interface looks like. GUI, CLI, I have no idea about that, but I know they're fairly inexpensive.
Yeah, I think that one, looking here, they've got two of them. They have 32 by 100 gig. One 6500, the other 500. I'm not quite sure yet of the difference. I wonder if maybe one of them, okay, one comes with a Broadcom OS, and the other one comes, you know, just with the, you know, standard bootloader.
Broadcom ICOS. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, they've got one that's 2040 gig and 400 gig. And talking to most of my carriers, they don't even want to sell me 40 gig interfaces anymore. They don't want to sell 40 gig circuits. They're basically saying that's legacy, we're depreciating that. We'll sell you 100 gig for the same price we would have sold you 40.
Yeah, which is disheartening, because we've got switches that have 16 40 gig ports on them. And nobody wants them. It's like, what if we give you three of them instead of the, you know, one 100, and, you know, we'll help cover the cost.
It's actually cheaper now for me to buy 40 10 gigs than one 40 gig interface. Did I say that right? Four 10 gigs as opposed to four or one 40 gig. Yeah. It's actually cheaper for me to just load up 10 gig interfaces. But the reason it upsets me is that stuff on the gray market is just now getting really inexpensive that has the 40 gig optics, and now the carriers are like, sorry, no bueno.
Places like Fiberstore are just finally getting them, getting those optics, down to a reasonable price. You know, they mm-hmm. still haven't come out with, gray market, 40 or, 100 gig optics yet. Doing CWDM or VWDM, they can do it. They just, no one's made them yet. And, already you're seeing the 100 gig or the 40 gigs fall by the wayside.
Yeah. So, FiberStore, 32, 100 gig interfaces, open network switch preloaded, ONI, $6,500.
Yeah. And so then with that, you know, for those that don't know, you would still have to then go out and purchase Cumulus Linux, Pika 8, you know, IP Infusion, WebOS.
Yeah. Looks like if you get it preloaded with the Broadcom, it's an extra $2,000. So it's $8,500 for that, for the Broadcom ICO system.
Yeah. I've seen some places that, you know, refer to Cumulus with FiberStore. Actually, one of the reviews on that switch you just mentioned talks about Cumulus. So I'm not sure if they're inferring that Cumulus came with it somehow, because it doesn't say that anywhere else.
Yeah, maybe tested already.
But I think I have seen some other Cumulus, you know, references with FiberStore, maybe on their LinkedIn or something. But
something else I'm thinking is, you have a pretty big audience here, and the Exchange has a pretty big audience, and you could probably do some good marketing for them. Maybe FiberStore would be willing to throw you a review sample of one of those 3200 gig interface switches.
Maybe I'll just say, hey, give me one of those.
Yeah, we can give you that much exposure.
Then we got to figure out, now how do we connect it back into our existing infrastructure that has all these 40s available.
It's only got 100 gig interfaces on it, so you got to hook it up to something that's got 100 gig.
Either you get a whole, like, all 32 are 100 gigs, or, like, you only get a couple hundred gigs.
They have another switch here that I'm looking at, 48, 10 gig, 240 gig, and 4 100 gig. So that seems like you could probably get away with that.
And
that could kind of bridge the gap in between everything.
Sure. Sure, yeah. I see a lot of people asking about 25 gig, because that's 25 gig is supposed to replace 10 gig, given that it's still just a single wave, and obviously faster. And they've got one on here that's $5,700. Yeah. 600 gigs, 48 25s. I mean, that seems probably like your best bang for the buck without going full 100 gig.
Yeah, I just don't have anything else with 25 gig.
Well, yeah, interfaces. Like, the only thing that does have 25 gig.
Yeah,
that's supposed to be a thing.
Future.
I just started those discussions about white box stuff. I know one of the other consultants out there, they've been doing some white boxing work, and they've got some blog posts up. There's some stuff out there
with stuff like this. It always, because I know I run into these problems sometimes, so I know other people, especially guys listening here, do. Say you do have a need for 100 gig, and you pull the trigger on that, and you get one. What do you do about spares on the shelf? If you go white box, are they going to overnight you a switch if one bricks? And are you at a place in your networks where you're able to sustain a 24-hour outage waiting for a new piece of gear to come in, right? So it's, do I need to go ahead and pull the trigger and have another one of these on the shelf? Do I need to do some kind of active thing? And can I afford that? And that,
sure.
It's always
such a pain. And to be fair, we're supposed to have, I forget which level, but same day service from Cisco on our Nexuses, and we didn't get that. So, I mean, like, we have the service, it just didn't happen.
Right. With most of my gear, I usually play the spare on the shelf game. Like, I've got to have a piece of equipment here just in case. I need an extra chassis. I need an extra supervisor. I got to have one of every line card, one extra of every optic. I literally have one extra of everything. And when you're buying brand new equipment, where it's hard enough for you to pick up one, it may almost be impossible to pick up two. And so that puts you in the situation where, all right, am I going to fly without a net. You know, am I going to walk the tightrope without a net for a little while and just wait a few months and then I could pick up the spare? But then sometimes I see people fall into a trap with that. You know, it's like, oh, okay. Well, you know what? This is working fine. I don't need a spare. And then they'll hit the year mark and then something will crap the bed. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. You know, sometimes you get too comfortable with those solutions, those band-aids. I don't know. I'm just super hyper paranoid. And I know a lot of what we do is built on reputation, right? And if you have a very significant failure, that's going to tarnish you, you know, is your rapport you have built with customers enough, right? So it's funny, if you're a faceless service provider, it's easy for people to eat your lunch. If you screw up, it's easy for them to mother truck you all day, you know what I mean? And talk trash. But if you actually have a relationship established with somebody, I'm not saying can get away with a lot more, but you have a lot more leeway, you know what I mean? So I guess you got to figure out how much political capital you have in what scenarios as far as spares on the shelf go. Because I know most of the guys listening here don't have the money sitting on the shelf or burning a hole in their pocket to where they can buy all that extra gear. So sure. It's tricky.
To kind of circle back on that dollar switch with just the Oni on it, I actually went through and actually kind of skimmed through its page, and it does support 40 gig interfaces modules. So I could get that one and then just put a 40 gig optic into into the port and back down.
That's nice. I didn't realize that the form factor for 40 and 100 was like compatible.
Yeah, because one's QSFP, I think the other's, well, QSFP plus, I think the other one's QSFP 28, which just means, you know, it has a 28 gigabit lane instead of a, what is it, I think 10 gigs actually 12 or something like that. You know, it's just different electronics. That's what I started to think about, is, you know, as we were talking, I was like, wait a minute, I remember seeing people talking about, you know, you can have a 100 gig interface through a breakout cable that then supports, you know, 40s, 25s, 50s, 10s.
Multiple 40s. That's cool.
Yeah. You know, but that's, you know, implementation specific. So I'm looking to see if this one did. And, you know, sure enough, it does. So
that's,
I couldn't
cool.
get that one.
That's super cool. And,
you know, just run a couple 40 gigs down to the Nexus. And you know, be all right.
Very cool. Man.
Yeah, and, you know, but there's so many vendors of these things too.
yeah.
You know, everybody knows Fiber Store, but you know, who's to say that they're, you know, they're even the one to buy from?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's, I mean, I think Ethernet switching is kind of new to them. And something we'll have to talk about in the future too is how Fiber Store's starting to do some active optical stuff. Let's not get into that. That's a whole can of worms. We're already at an hour.
Yeah, best to have Thrift on that show anyway.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's the dude for that. Let's close out the list a little bit. You have Wispalooza calendar up shared.
Sure. Yes. So last at Wisp America, after hearing lots of people complaining about, you know, not knowing when things were, and you know, they have an official Groupio app that has schedules and things, but it's cumbersome. So I just sat down one, you know, 10 minutes. I just put in that day's schedule into Google Calendar. I said, here's some things in Google Calendar. But I'm at the show, so I have limited time to making that. So like a week or two ago, I thought, hey, let's try making this calendar ahead of time instead of while I'm at the show. And then, because my main thing was, how do I know who's vendor, you know, which vendor's things to, you know, RSVP to, which one's not to, you know, which one's conflict, you know, or which one's conflict, which ones are on, you know, what days. So I thought, well, let's put the vendor's ones in there too. And and kind of rolling this in with, at about the same time I was thinking about this, is when we were having good conversations about, you know, our press passes we have this year, and, you know, who's going to go. I was like, well, you know, now we got free press passes, but the guys that are going aren't, you know, to fill those spots aren't necessarily, you know, full-time WISPs. So it's kind of, you know, money out of their pocket and time away from work for them to go. Hey, let's solve these two things at once. I'm just thinking about how we put vendors on the list, and how we need maybe some money for these guys to get to the show. So I thought, hey, I'll put all the WISP stuff in there for free. Vendors, if you want your event in there, give us money.
Huzzah. That's cool.
Actually, I sent that email out about 2 hours ago.
Very enterprising.
To the vendors, and actually told them, we're not asking a certain amount. You give however much you want. By the way, we will publish not what you gave us, dollar amount, but we will rank you. We'll give us the least.
How funny. Give what you can. Well, it is Vegas, so they can probably pay you in other interesting ways.
Yeah, but like, you know, I figured it's probably going to cost, you know, you know, even with sharing rooms, it's probably, you know, it probably still, you know, still costs, you know, $1,000 to get, you know, two guys there, you know, and the room, you know, maybe even $1,500 for all that. And so, you know, with all the vendors that are there, you know, it's not really that much. They just each chip in a little. So.
For sure. For sure. All right. So moving right along, Midwest IX is looking for a sales leader. Tell me about that.
We're tech guys and we suck at sales. no, but and actually somebody at a conference brought this up to me, how chasing sales leads, while critical, because if I don't do it, or
nobody
if
will.
My partner doesn't do it, nobody's doing it.
Yeah.
And you need to do that to get money. While critical, probably not the best use of our time, being, you know, network engineers that put all this together. And while we're spending our time on something that we're maybe not that good at, you know, somebody else is good at that. So we're basically looking at somebody that we can say, here's some money. Well, not like a big fat chunk up front, you know, but, you know, we'll give you money if you bring people to us, you know, signed contracts. You know, it's not a full-time gig, you know. Like, you know, we're not expecting to, you know, compensate somebody, you know, $60,000-$70,000 a year for doing this. But, you know somebody that's got some free time that, you know, has done sales stuff.
Right. Up in the Chicago area? That's what you're looking for?
Well, I mean, you know, most of it would probably be just, you know, work from home type stuff. But obviously, if you're in the Midwest area and are cognizant of where cities are, and it's not unreasonable to travel if need be, you know, somebody from Alaska, not quite your thing, cost you $2,000 to get here.
Yeah. Jeremy Austin's out then.
But, you know, somebody in the, you know, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, you know, a little bit south, a little bit north, a little bit east, a little bit west, you know, somewhere around in that area. If you think you can do salesy stuff for us, then let us know.
Excellent. One other thing you have on the list is Unimus Beta licensing.
Yes,
what's the story on that?
You know, how unfortunate for us is it that Thomas decides that he needs to sleep?
Finally.
Because, like, we don't usually start these shows until it's, like 2 a.m. his time.
Yeah.
And so he's deciding to go to bed instead. So I figured I'd pop in and say that I just recently saw an email. Well, there's been a couple emails about promos and things. But if you have beta licenses from Unimus, they will expire, I believe, September 1st. I didn't read this, but I would assume that you don't lose what you already have in terms of backups. You just, I assume it just stops functioning. I assume, you know, getting more backups. Ingenuous is cheap, and I've got a couple emails from them so far. You know, here's some, you know, discount codes for, you know, beta users and things like that. So
that's cool.
If he's making it easy for you to move to a real license, giving him money. And really, it's not even a lot of money. It's like $350 per device, you know, one-time charge. You know, bulk discounts available. But, yeah, so put that out there, because you go 2 more weeks from this show and your licenses will have been expired, so.
Oh, yeah. All right, we'll get out there and get you some of the real stuff, some of the good Unimus dollars. I guess we're over an hour, so we probably need to kill it. Let's put a fork in it. Mike, if people want to get a hold of you on the internet, what's the best way for them to do that?
Probably just Google for me and choose your medium of choice. Social media, various social media platforms, emails. I'm typically the one that's manning the Brothers Wisp Facebook account. Even though every now and then I see Wilson or Greg pop in there and take something, but usually it's me. So if you can't find me anywhere else, maybe I should change it and say, if you can't find me anywhere else, I probably don't want you contacting me, because.
Follow me on Facebook, follow me on YouTube, don't follow me in real life. I gotcha.
If you're going to give me money, you can.
I don't think anybody wants to give you money, Mike. But yeah, as Mike
That's
said...
That's why I'm here talking to you.
I thought you're a masochist. I just thought you like to abuse yourself. I didn't know why else you'd be here. Yeah, like Mike said earlier, if you are on the Facebook, if you like what you're seeing... that is pretty much all him. He's the aggregator of news. He is very responsive whenever you guys post stuff or post comments back. He's Johnny on the spot. So can't say enough good stuff about Mike staying on top of that, because I know none of us have the stick-to-itiveness to do it that he does. So thank you, Mike, again for that. If you wanted to get a hold of me in the real world, you can hit me at my blog. I almost said the Brothers Wisp. It's gregsoul.com. I actually put up my first legitimate post in ages a few days ago. I'm trying to get back into every week, every 2 weeks, something like that. It was, speaking of BGP, it's actually a post about if you're using layer 2 switching to bridge remote sites and you're doing BGP, it's how you can give your switches a little bit of intelligence to kind of flap those BGP links if your transit goes down. Otherwise, you can have a bad 3 minutes or so in between. Let's see.
Or much longer if you're using a CCR.
Yeah. Don't do that. Anyway, you can get me on there. You can also, if you're old school and you want to email us, it's contactus@thebrotherswisp.com. The website is thebrotherswisp.com. If you want to grab the podcast... apparently some people watch this on YouTube. So if you're watching this on YouTube, we actually do it in podcasts. You can grab it on your podcatcher. It's up immediately. As soon as the video is live, the podcast is live for your podcatcher. So if you prefer to just listen, on your way to work, something like that, as opposed to staring at our mugs, I would go that route. Definitely. All right.
But, one more thing I just thought of in regards to messaging us on Facebook. Please tell us what you want. Last person that messaged us said, "Hello, I have a problem. Can you help me?" I responded back with maybe ? Because I don't know what the problem is. I can't help him fix his car. but then he never followed up with what he actually needed. So, yeah.
In addition to that, Mike posted up just before this cast, "Hey, what do you guys want to hear?" Two of those requests actually made it into this cast. So please tell us what you want to hear about, and we will absolutely talk about it.
Yeah, and I suppose that if we had more time, you probably could have gone on, but we tangented it. So
yeah.
But that's I guess
hours a good mark. I don't know that people can survive it much longer than that.
I really can't survive much more than an hour of you. So
right, yeah. I hate myself right now. This is about all. This is about all I can take. No, I love the sound of my own voice. Why do you think I do this crap? So from us, from me, from Greg. Thanks, Mike, for being here. Thank you all you guys for listening. Please keep sending us questions, comments, and we'll see you next time.